Chapter 9. Up the hillside, in deeper shadow, was another little structure. A wooden shed with an open gable sheltering an altar with candles and flowers. Hear masses said by one of the conscript priests of the regiment, while his congregation kneel between the fir trunks, giving life to the old metaphor of the cathedral forest. Nearby was the graveyard, where day by day these quiet elderly men lay their comrades, the pares de famille who don't go back. The care of this woodland cemetery is left entirely to the soldiers, and they have spent treasures of piety on the inscriptions and decorations of the graves. Fresh flowers are brought up from the valleys to cover them, and when some favorite comrade goes, the men scorning ephemeral tributes, club together to buy a monstrous indestructible wreath with emblazoned streamers. It was near the end of the afternoon, and many soldiers were strolling along the paths between the graves. It's their favorite walk at this hour, the colonel said. He stopped to look down on a grave smothered in beady tokens, the grave of the last pal to fall. He was mentioned in the order of the day, the colonel explained. And the group of soldiers standing near looked at us proudly, as if sharing their comrade's honor, and wanting to be sure that we understood the reason of their pride. And now, said our captain of chasseurs, that you've seen the second line trenches, what do you say to taking a look at the first? We followed him to a point higher up the hill, where we plunged into a deep ditch of red earth, the owl leading to the first lines. It climbed still higher, under the wet firs, and then, turning, dipped over the edge, and began to wind in sharp loops down the other side of the ridge. Down we scrambled, single file, our chins on the level with the top of the passage, the close green covert above us. The owl went twisting down more and more sharply into a deep ravine, and presently, at a bend, we came to a fir-thatched outlook, where a soldier stood with his back to us, his eye glued to a peephole in the wattled wall. Another turn, and another outlook. But here it was the iron-rimmed eye of the mitrailleuse that stared across the ravine. By this time we were within 100 yards or so of the German lines, hidden, like ours, on the other side of the narrowing hollow. And as we stole down and down, the hush and secrecy of the scene, and the sense of that imminent lurking hatred only a few branch lengths away, seemed to fill the silence with mysterious pulsations. Suddenly a sharp noise broke on them. The rap of a rifle shot against a tree trunk a few yards ahead. Ah, the sharp shooter, said our guide. And no more talking. Please, he's over there, in a tree somewhere, and whenever he hears voices he fires. Someday we shall spot his tree. We went on in silence to a point, where a few soldiers were sitting on a ledge of rock in a widening of the owl. They looked as quiet as if they had been waiting for their box before a boulevard cafe. Not beyond, please, said the officer, holding me back, and I stopped. Here we were, then, actually, and literally in the first lines. The knowledge made one's heart tick a little, but, except for another shot or two from our arboreal listener, and the motionless intentness of the soldiers back at the peephole, there was nothing to show that we were not a dozen miles away. Perhaps the thought occurred to our captain of chasseurs. For just as I was turning back he said with his friendliest twinkle, colon, do you want awfully to go a little farther? Well then, come on. We went past the soldiers sitting on the ledge, and stole down and down, to where the trees ended at the bottom of the ravine. The sharpshooter had stopped firing, and nothing disturbed the leafy silence, but an intermittent drip of rain. We were at the end of the burrow, and the captain signed to me that I might take a cautious peep round its corner. I looked out and saw a strip of intensely green meadow just under me, and a wooded cliff rising abruptly on its other side. That was all. The wooded cliff swarmed with hem, and a few steps would have carried us across the interval. Yet all about us was silence, and the peace of the forest. Again, for a minute, I had the sense of an all-pervading, invisible power of evil, a saturation of the whole landscape with some hidden vitriol of hate. Then the reaction of the unbelief set in, and I felt myself in a harmless ordinary glen, like a million others on an untroubled earth. We turned and began to climb again, loop by loop, up the bowel we passed the lolling soldiers, the silent Matreus. We came again to the watcher at his peephole. He heard us, let the officer pass, and turned his head with a little sign of understanding. Do you want to look down? He moved a step away from his window. The lookout projected over the ravine, raking its depths. And here, with one's eye to the leaf-lashed hole, one saw at last. Saw, at the bottom of the harmless glen, halfway between cliff and cliff, a gray uniform huddled in a dead heap. He's been there for days. They can't fetch him away, said the watcher, re-gluing his eye to the hole, and it was almost a relief to find it was after all a tangible enemy hidden over there across the meadow. The sun had set when we got back to our starting point in the underground village. The chasseurs a pied were lounging along the roadside and standing in gossiping groups about the motor. It was long since they had seen faces from the other life, the life they had left nearly a year earlier and had not been allowed to go back to for a day, and under all their jokes and good humor their farewell had a tinge of wistfulness. But one felt that this fugitive reminder of a world they had put behind them would pass like a dream, and their minds revert without effort to the one reality, the business of holding their bit of France. It is hard to say why this sense of the French soldier's single-mindedness is so strong in all who have had even a glimpse of the front. Perhaps it is gathered less from what the men say than from the look in their eyes. Even while they are accepting cigarettes and exchanging trench jokes, the look is there, and when one comes on them unaware it is there also. In the dusk of the forest, that look followed us down the mountain, and as we skirted the edge of the ravine between the armies, we felt that on the far side of that dividing line were the men who had made the war, and on the near side the men who had been made by it. In the north, June 19, 1915. On the way from Doulens to Montreuil-sur-Mer, on a shining summer afternoon. A road between moldy hedges, choked, literally strangled, by a torrent of westward streaming troops of all arms. Every few minutes there would come a break in the flow, and our motor would wriggle through, advance a few yards, and be stopped again by a widening of the torrent that jammed us into the ditch, and splashed a dazzle of dust into our eyes. The dust was stifling, but through it, what a sight! Standing up in the car and looking back, we watched the river of war wind toward us. Cavalry, artillery, lancers, infantry, sappers and miners, trench diggers, road makers, stretcher bearers, they swept on as smoothly as if in holiday order. Through the dust, the sun picked out the flash of lances, and the gloss of chargers' flanks, flushed rows and rows of determined faces, found the least touch of gold on faded uniforms, silvered the sad gray of mitrailleuses and munition wagons. Close as the men were, they seemed allegorically splendid. As if, under the arch of the sunset, we had been watching the whole French army ride straight into glory. Finally we left the last detachment behind, and had the country to ourselves. The disfigurement of war has not touched the fields of Artois. The thatched farmhouses dozed in gardens full of roses and hollyhocks, and the hedges above the duck ponds were weighed down with layers of elder blossom. On all sides wheat fields skirted with woodland went billowing away under the breezy light that seemed to carry a breath of the Atlantic on its beams. The road ran up and down, as if our motor were a ship on a deep sea swell, and such a sense of space and light was in the distances, such a veil of beauty over the whole world, that the vision of that army on the move grew more and more fabulous and epic. The sun had set and the sea twilight was rolling in when we dipped down from the town of Montreuil to the valley below, where the towers of an ancient abbey church rise above terraced orchards. The gates at the end of the avenue were thrown open, and the motor drove into a monastery court full of box and roses. Everything was sweet and secluded in this medieval place, and from the shadow of cloisters and arched passages groups of nuns fluttered out, nuns all black or all white, gliding, peering, and standing at gaze. It was as if we had plunged back into a century to which motors were unknown, and our car had been some monster cast up from a Barbary shipwreck. And the startled attitudes of these holy women did credit to their sense of the picturesque. For the Abbey of Neuville is now a great Belgian hospital, and such monsters must frequently intrude on its seclusion. Sunset, and summer dusk, and the moon. Under the monastery windows a walled garden with stone pavilions at the angles, and the drip of a fountain. Below it, tiers of orchard terraces fading into a great moon-confused plain that might be either fields or sea. June 20th. Today our way ran northeast, through a landscape, so English that there was no incongruity in the sprinkling of cacti along the road. Even the villages look English. The same plum red brick of tidy self-respecting houses, neat, demure and freshly painted, the gardens all bursting with flowers, the landscape hedgerowed and willowed and fed with watercourses, the people's faces square and pink and honest, and the signs over the shops, in a language halfway between English and German. Only the architecture of the towns is French, of a reserved and robust northern type, but unmistakably in the same great tradition. War still seemed so far off that one had time for these digressions as the motor flew on over the undulating miles. But presently we came on an aviation camp spreading its sheds over a wide plateau. Here the cacti throng was thicker, and the familiar military stir enlivened the landscape. A few miles farther, and we found ourselves in what was seemingly a big English town oddly grouped about a nucleus of French churches. This was Saint-Omer, gray, spacious, coldly clean in its Sunday emptiness. At the street crossings English sentries stood mechanically directing the absent traffic with gestures familiar to Piccadilly, and the signs of the British Red Cross and St. John's Ambulance hung on club-like facades that might almost have claimed a home in Pall Mall. The Englishness of things was emphasized, as we passed out through the suburbs, by the look of the crowd on the canal bridges and along the roads. Every nation has its own way of loitering, and there is nothing so unlike the French way as the English. Even if all these tall youths had not been in khaki, and the girls with them so pink and countrified, one would instantly have recognized the passive northern way of letting a holiday soak in instead of squeezing out its juices with feverish fingers. When we turned westward from Saint-Omer, across the same pastures and watercourses, we were faced by two hills standing up abruptly out of the plain. And on the top of one rose the walls and towers of a compact little medieval town. As we took the windings that led up to it, a sense of Italy began to penetrate the persistent impression of being somewhere near the English Channel. The town we were approaching might have been a queer dream blend of Winchelsea and San Gimignano. But when we entered the gates of Castle we were in a place so intensely itself that all analogies dropped out of mind. It was not surprising to learn from the guidebook that Castle has the most extensive view of any town in Europe. One felt at once that it differed in all sorts of marked and self-assertive ways from every other town, and would be almost sure to have the best things going in every line. And the line of an illimitable horizon is exactly the best to set off its own quaint compactness. We found our hotel in the most perfect of little market squares, with a Renaissance town hall on one side, and on the other a miniature Spanish palace with a front of rosy brick adorned by gray carvings. The square was crowded with English army motors and beautiful prancing chargers, and the restaurant of the inn, which has the luck to face the pink and gray palace, swarmed with khaki tea drinkers turning indifferent shoulders to the widest view in Europe. It is one of the most detestable things about war, that everything connected with it, except the death and ruin that result, is such a heightening of life, so visually stimulating and absorbing. It was gay and terrible, is the phrase forever recurring in R and Peace, and the gaiety of war was everywhere in Castle, transforming the lifeless little town into a romantic stage setting full of the flash of arms, and the virile animation of young faces. From the park on top of the hill we looked down on another picture. All about us was the plain, its distant rim merged in northern sea mist, and through the mist, in the glitter of the afternoon sun, far-off towns and shadowy towers lay steeped, as it seemed, in summer quiet. For a moment, while we looked, the vision of war shriveled up like a painted veil. Then we caught the names pronounced by a group of English soldiers leaning over the parapet at our side. T, that's Dunkirk, one of them pointed it out with his pipe, and D, there's Poperinghe, just under us. That's Ferns Beyond, and Ypres and Dixmude, and Newport. Dot, and at the mention of those names the scene grew dark again, and we felt the passing of the angel to whom was given the key of the bottomless pit. That night we went up once more to the rock of Castle. The moon was full, and as civilians are not allowed out alone after dark, a staff officer went with us to show us the view from the roof of the disused casino on top of the rock. It was the queerest of sensations, to push open a glazed door, and find ourselves in a spectral painted room with soldiers dozing in the moonlight on polished floors, their kits stacked on the gaming tables. We passed through a big vestibule among more soldiers lounging in the half-light, and up a long staircase to the roof, where a watcher challenged us, and then let us go to the edge of the parapet. Directly below lay the unlit mass of the town. To the northwest a single sharp hill, beyond the Cats, stood out against the sky. The rest of the horizon was unbroken, and floating in misty moonlight. The outline of the ruined towns had vanished and peace seemed to have won back the world. But as we stood there a red flash started out of the mist far off to the northwest. Then another and another flickered up at different points of the long curve. Luminous bombs thrown up along the lines, our guide explained. And just then, at still another point a white light opened like a tropical flower, spread to full bloom, and drew itself back into the night. A flare, we were told, and another white flower bloomed out farther down. Below us, the roofs of Castle slept their provincial sleep, the moonlight picking out every leaf in the gardens, while beyond, those infernal flowers continued to open and shut along the curve of death. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.